Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Joe Flora. Joe is a longtime member of the faculty at the University of North Carolina. Most folks in Chapel Hill know him. Former chairman of the English faculty, and right now he's serving as the interim director of the Center for the Study of the American South, and doing a bang-up job with that, Joe. Thank you for jumping in. And the place is blooming. Poor old Harry Watson's going to have a hard time filling your shoes when he comes back.
Oh, wow.
But that's been great. One of the things that I didn't know about you was your extraordinary and longtime interest in Ernest Hemingway. We know you, I mean, you've been associated with other authors and then on the bandwagon. I think, were you chairman of the, or head of the Thomas Wolfe Society? Have you been?
I've been president of the Thomas Wolfe Society, indeed.
And
I'm still very active in the Thomas Wolfe Society.
And other authors. But those of us who didn't know that, who live in Chapel Hill and didn't do that, well, we ought to be spanked anyway. But the publication of your newest book, Reading Hemingway's Men Without Women, which it was a collection of short stories, and you've provided, I don't know what you'd call it, but you've provided sort of a reader's guide, a roadmap, a tourist guide, mm-hmm. kind of, to reading the short stories in that collection. Would remind those who knew that you're a Hemingway expert, and then those of us who didn't know that have introduced us to that idea. So I just grabbed you to come talk about Ernest Hemingway with us. Will you do that?
I love to talk about Ernest Hemingway, the most teachable of writers.
Why is that? He is a popular writer for young people, or at least he was when I was growing up. It was the why is it that young people like Hemingway, like a lot of young people like Thomas Wolfe?
They like Hemingway because he talks about real issues. There is a sense of drama that is there, and there is always more than they at first see. Now, you have to admit, Hemingway fell down a little bit, and women sometimes still draw back from Ernest Hemingway. And sometimes you will get women students who have that idea that he is that male chauvinist pig, and they're not very interested in him. If I do a good job in the class, they at least come halfway towards seeing what those stories are and the complexity, and I think a view of women that is often surprisingly sympathetic.
Oh, so you take it, I mean, my thought was that you would just say, look, he's a good writer, and you learn about his writing techniques. You don't have to like his attitudes towards women. So you've even persuaded them that his attitude, that some of his treatment of women is very respectful and sympathetic, and that he wasn't a male chauvinist pig after all.
Well, you do that by looking at the artistry of the story and seeing what is really there, what we see more than that, what we feel. I think those gendered stories still speak very much to debates and issues that are going on today. As the title of this collection, Men Without Women. Men with women on the face of it, but not maybe emotionally connected. It's a very complex reality, and Hemingway was always dependent on women. He had, 3-4 sisters? He's got a very strong mother. He marries young, and when he remarries, which became a habit, the next wife was always in line before he got divorced. So there was always a woman there, and some others along the way as well.
Well, put him in perspective for what do you tell your students who are not totally informed about Hemingway when you get to the Hemingway chapter, the Hemingway lecture. What is it that's most important for all of us to be sure that we understand and remember? And I asked that question with the wrong assumption. That is that Hemingway is not, as we might wish he to be, exactly a part of the common American culture any longer. You have to delve into it a little bit to get Hemingway to be, you have to introduce him. You can't assume that people all know about him when you start off.
Well, pretty much they still do know about him because he was bigger than life. He was a public presence in a way that I think no novelist now that we have writing is news the way Hemingway the person was. He was such a public figure.
Well, I saw you grimace when I made that assertion, and I just argue that what you say is totally right for the time when I was growing up, which was before and started reading before before Hemingway's death. But now he's been dead for more than 50 years, I guess, and for 50 years or so, and the coming generation has not experienced him as a news figure, as someone that whom they would read about as a celebrity like we did.
No, but if you watch Jeopardy at all, you will find that there's going to be a Hemingway question fairly regularly in which Hemingway's the answer or you give the title. But maybe you're right. Sometimes I'm surprised when they miss the Hemingway connection. Mm-hmm. Usually it's one of the easier questions, and the contestant, sometimes a young person, will miss it. But you make a good point, because when we were in college and now, there is so much more that has been written in American literature, in the English language, for them to have heard about, to react to know. And so writers don't grip them in the same way. Where, for instance, at the present moment, is the poet who would equal Frost or T.S. Eliot in an undergraduate's mind, unless they're really into poetry or something?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the other, getting back to Hemingway, one of the other things that makes it, arguably, makes him less a force than you might expect, given how important he is in the pantheon, is this tendency that you mentioned among your women students to not to appreciate Hemingway because of, at least on the surface, his male chauvinist pig aspects, and to a certain extent that probably some of the women who are leaders in the academic field, in the English language and literature field, may not be as enthusiastic about Hemingway as the male teachers 50 years ago would have been, almost universally arguing that Hemingway's one of the most important figures.
Feminist criticism actually has done a lot to correct that. And you have a number of women scholars who are intensely devoted to Hemingway, Susan Beagle being a very good example, our own Linda Wagner Martin of our English department. And Hemingway has been an abiding interest with them. And that you have women also very active for Hemingway scholarship and dealing with issues of gender in these stories has helped us see the stories better and brought women readers
think. Well, all this came from my original question, which was, I shouldn't have put a preface to it, but was, what do you tell folks about Hemingway when you first encounter them as students?
Maybe you're helping me that I have to give a little more introduction than I have in the past, because I assume, and usually that's right, they will have read a story by Hemingway in high school. They may have reacted to it in an adverse way, as one student talking about Steinbeck had to read The Red Pony in high school, and so she hated it, and so hated Steinbeck. And then we did The Grapes of Wrath, and she made her peace with Steinbeck at that point. So sometimes what they got, and that he is the academic, might be a burden to overcome, and I've got to be more aware of that.
Well, let's take a quick break and then come back and talk about your book, Reading Hemingway's Men Without Women. I'm talking to Joe Flora. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Joe Flora. Joe is a former chairman of the English department here at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, longtime resident of Chapel Hill, is the interim director of the Center for the Study of American South, lots of other things, written lots of books. His latest book is a part of a series which is what will be a series of guidebooks for readers of Ernest Hemingway's works. I guess there's already one that's out on The Sun Also Rises.
Correct.
And then your book, which has just come out, which is Reading Hemingway's Men Without Women, and that was a collection of short stories. Can you put The Sun Also Rises and then the book that you've written about, Men Without Women, can you put that sort of in the context of Hemingway's development as a writer?
That's a good question, because this is really the next book after The Sun Also Rises. The Sun Also Rises has made a big splash. It's made Hemingway widely known, and people love it. And so to keep his name fresh and so on, another collection of short stories is going to come. So this collection, when it comes out, is going to get an enormous amount of attention. And it does. And obviously, Hemingway does not want to let down in the caliber of the artistry, the things that brought him praise for The Sun Also Rises.
I want you to back up, if you would, and talk about The Sun Also Rises and why, what it was and why it was so immediately successful and brought so much attention to Ernest Hemingway.
It is a Bildungsroman, which means it's a novel that deals with the life of an artist. It is a roman de clay, which means that it's based on real people. And when you're reading Hemingway stories, certainly Men Without Women, they are not the portraits of Ernest Hemingway. He's not Nick Adams, but he also is Nick Adams. And other characters and people are reflected. He is like Thomas Wolfe, a writer who very much dealt with experiences that he had had, people whom he had known. He's every bit as much an autobiographical writer in the sense that Thomas Wolfe is, which might be surprising to some people.
Well, in some respects, at least in at this time period, this is about 1926 or 7, these guys, Thomas Wolfe and Ernest Hemingway, were age contemporaries.
Yes.
And contemporaries in other ways as well, were they?
In contemporaries in the sense of being rivals. They're contemporaries in both having the same publisher and having the same editor. And the relationship was complex. I think they met only once, but they were always very, very aware of each other. And Max Perkins, the editor, his favorite was Thomas Wolfe because he had worked so closely with him, reacted with the work and helped shape the work in ways that he did not do that with Hemingway. He admired, he saw the brilliance and the genius that was there in this other young person. And so it was a sibling rivalry that was going on, because Max Perkins, in a certain sense, is something like a father figure for both of these writers.
Kind of a Cain and Abel sort of
thing? A bit of the Cain and Abel. And Hemingway, being very astute, very much sort of felt that Wolfe was the favorite. They called him that big glandular genius in talking in a letter to Max Perkins. And I suppose, and when Wolfe died, of course, Perkins was very involved and very involved in the estate afterwards, because he cared as a human being and was compassionate. Maybe a part of Hemingway am I loved that much.
Well, it's... For this lay reader, the difference between the styles of the two men is so there's so much difference that it's instructive, or must be fun for a English professor to say, here's one way to describe a scene with long, flowing narrative paragraphs that go on and on, and then another where you're hard to find a sentence that's over 8 words long. It's
You're right. There is a crispness about so much of Hemingway, although he could be lyrical too. But Wolfe could overwhelm us with the lyrical and go on with the lyrical. And some have felt Wolfe let the words take over more than they should. Fitzgerald, who is also in that sibling rivalry relationship with them, famously said that Wolfe should learn to take out, that all these great writers look at their examples. And Wolfe came back that Shakespeare and others were putter-inners, and he was a putter-inner. Well, Hemingway's a taker-outer. Hemingway's liked to tell you much with little, much with little. I'm not saying you do not get sometimes powerful emotional feeling from Wolfe, but certainly their approach was very, very different.
Yeah, well, we could talk more about that. I'm glad you brought up Scott Fitzgerald, who was also had a very strong connection, as you point out in your new book, to the career of Ernest Hemingway, and was his advocate with the publishers, at least in the beginning.
He certainly was his advocate, and is responsible really for Hemingway's becoming a Scribner writer. There was admiration for the prose, the style. Fitzgerald could be the most mature of them at moments. And when you read his criticism in the letters and so on, very, very thoughtful and not dismissive in the way that Wolfe could be of his rivals in the big put down. There was in the letters, I think, sometimes that you do get the sense of Fitzgerald's maturity in talking about his peers.
Fitzgerald, of course, has extraordinary connections to North Carolina, and of course, Wolfe grew up here. I guess both Wolfe and Fitzgerald to the Asheville area. So far as I could determine, and I didn't find out anything else in your book about the North Carolina connections, have we covered it in terms of the
I think pretty much we've covered it. Hemingway would have passed through on the train going from New York down to Key West, but he didn't linger. But of course he knew when Fitzgerald was up there in Asheville and what Fitzgerald was going through with Zelda. He was very harsh on Zelda.
Oh, really? He was.
Hemingway lay a lot of the fault for Fitzgerald's demise and weaknesses on Zelda as the destructive woman.
Let me ask you another question, and you're so gentle with me when I ask the crazy questions. But the other comparison between Wolfe and Hemingway. You didn't say this, but I got going in this direction thanks to your book suggestion that Hemingway really was an extraordinarily gifted story writer, even more so than he was as a novelist. And on the other hand, I think of Wolfe as needing the novel's length in order to explore the kinds of things that he did. So you had these guys who one liked to write long stuff and one liked to write short stuff, or one was better writing short stuff.
Yes. Well, it's true that Max Perkins wanted his writers to also have those shorter books to keep their name going while they're working on the novel. And Wolfe worked very closely with Ellen Nowell, who would take a piece and pare it down to get it in size that could get into a magazine. Hugh Holman of our department, though, argued that Wolfe's real genre was not the novel, but the novella or the short novel. That's really where Wolfe was the genius, in Hugh Holman's view.
Well, the Lost Boy is the only...
The Lost Boy is a marvelous example of that.
But and there were others?
There are others. Death by Morning, Lost Man. There are others that you can find .
Yeah, well, it's so interesting, and all this is counterintuitive for me because getting back to Hemingway, the idea that Hemingway's a better short story writer than he is a novelist, and yet many of us growing up, For Whom the Bell Tolls, and we talked about The Sun Also Rises, you know, these were great novels for us, but you don't think they're...
I do think they're great novels. I do think they're great novels. I'm just saying, if you put a gun and say, which must we absolutely have, if we have to have a choice. The Sun Also Rises is a great novel, and so is For Whom the Bell Tolls, and so is A Farewell to Arms. They carry you away. They're vivid. They're worth reading. They're worth rereading.
Good. Okay. Well I'm glad. Now we'll stop that argument and take a break. We're going to come back and talk with Professor Joe Flora a little bit more about Ernest Hemingway, and we're going to do it in the context of his new book, which is Reading, Hemingway's Men Without Women. That was a collection of short stories, and we'll talk about that book when we come back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Joe Flora is my guest. Joe, you're, at least for a little while longer, the interim chairman of the Center for the Study of American South. Ernest Hemingway had nothing to do with the American South, and yet your latest book is just a real exploration of the Ernest Hemingway's important contributions to American literature.
Oh, I want to claim the influence of the South on Ernest Hemingway.
Oh, would you really?
Oh, I really do. How about Key West as our most southern city? And then you've got Cuba later, all the time in Bimini, and he marries his second wife is from Piggott, Arkansas. And if you go to Piggott, Arkansas, you can visit the home of the in-laws, and there it's now a Hemingway Museum. It's a must-space for you to visit on your Hemingway travels. So Piggott, Arkansas, and it'll blow your mind away because you think, here's this man who has been in Paris, sitting on the boulevards and in all the cafes and so on, and here I am in Piggott, and you try to see him sitting in one of the cafes and so on. This is not the world that Ernest had become accustomed to.
Oh, man, that's such a great point. And the only other occasion that I can think of where such a cosmopolitan person gets mixed up with the Arkansasian, in South Pacific. And when the little rock little girl becomes all messed up with the French, French plantation owner and all of that stuff. But that's really interesting. So you're not just arguing, you really believe that the South and the Southern people and the experiences with his second wife and living in Key West had an important Southern influence on his work.
I think the story that will get that most to you is the story Fathers and Sons, in which Nick Adams is driving across the South and sees the red soil and then compares that to his Midwestern reality and roots. So you'll get that nice flavor of Southern landscape there.
Well, let's talk about your book, your latest book, which is I've been describing it, but I'll let you describe what your book, Reading Hemingway's Men Without Women. What is all that about?
I suppose one of the things it is reclaiming for some of those general readers the sense that there is a book called Men Without Women, because they will have heard of many of those stories, but they will have read them in the complete stories and wouldn't be aware of them as a collection. And one of the things I want to do is to stress how these stories fit together, how they play against each other in interesting ways, and how that when the book was published, Men Without Women, Hemingway has a kind of sense of how these stories fit together and comment on each other, making them a kind of novel. Not a novel, but a novella that bears characteristics of the novel.
Well, it's interesting. You made the point that you're writing about a book that hardly exists anymore, in the sense that it was a collection of short stories which was published as a unit and had, you could argue that it was just all the stories that he happened to have available now, but it had arguably, and you make an important argument, that it has very important crossover themes and was appropriately titled. But today we go and we get the complete short stories of Ernest Hemingway, and you have to kind of do a little bit of research to find out which ones of those stories were in the collection that you've dealt with, Men Without Women.
Yeah. I mean, it will be made easier for you, because when the complete short stories, the collected stories, were published by Scribner's in Hemingway's lifetime, they were always done in the order that Hemingway worked at to get them in this book. When that book was published, I read one Hemingway critic who said, it's too bad they were not given to us in chronological order, in the order of their composition. I suppose for certain kind of scholar, that would have a kind of interest to read them that way. But that wasn't the way Hemingway planned for us to read those stories. And he held to that order.
Well, it's interesting, Joe. I'm worried about that. When I went to the, and this is just too off base, but let me do this private conversation with you. I worried about it because I couldn't find Men Without Women, except in rare editions almost that you could get it. But the complete short stories of Ernest Hemingway is still in print. You can still get it, and it's. I said, how am I going to sort out and find out these stories? I've got to pick all the way through it and pick out the ones. And you're right. When I went to the index, they're all in the order, just like they were in Men Without Women, but it's not in the Men Without Women section. It just happens to be in that order. So it was easy. It was easy to read them in the order that you describe them or that you deal with them in your book. Well, you tell me about these stories and why they held together and why they were important in terms of Ernest Hemingway's career and in terms of the contribution that he has made to American literature. What's so good about them?
What is so good about them? That's inviting a 90-minute lecture, isn't it? And to do that, you start dealing with the stories, you start dealing with the quality of the prose, the beauty often of the prose, as in Another Country, that opening of that story that just blows your mind away. Fitzgerald absolutely loved it. So many have absolutely loved it. Any student I've ever had who really reads is going to love that as well. So there is the prose, and when you see the when you look back at the story, and you always have to look back at Hemingway's stories, see how much of the story is really already there in that opening, So the quality of the prose is there, the sense of how often it is poetry. Also, of course, the sense of dialogue. Hemingway's famous for writing dialogue that can really get hold of a reader. So if you look at a story like The Killers, for instance, that story is almost all dialogue. And you're hearing these tough people talking. And that's the way some people think all of Hemingway is, just that kind of tough kind of world. But what a master of dialogue that is there.
Well, you picked the Killers, which is one of the extraordinarily good stories in this collection that you write about, and you've also mentioned Nick Adams, who appears in this story as the only main character, but as an important character, but maybe so tell us about Nick Adams' role in the story. Tell us the story of The Killers. Set that story up for us, and then tell us how Nick Adams played a part in it and why it's a good story.
That's one of the things about the book, isn't it? That there is that surprise that eventually you find out in the story that it really is about Nick. You couldn't tell that at the beginning. You thought it was about the killers who have come in and that they've been hired to kill someone and they're waiting. And the story's about waiting, isn't it? There's no No one gets shot in this story.
It's the story of my life. I'm waiting to do something important.
Waiting to do something, and the kind of waiting theme is.
So we got two gang members or two guys who come into this cafe or restaurant. It's in Chicago, and they're tough guys, and they talk to these two kids, one of whom is Nick Adams, and they bully them around a little bit, and then it turns out they're really, really bad guys. They go into the kitchen and get the cook, and they set up a stage to kill somebody for some reason. We're not really sure, and we're waiting for the gun to go off, and it never goes off. And then what happens? And then what? I mean, then it's just kind of peters out, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, does it? Or are you left at the end of that story? So what has this experience done to this young man? How has it changed his life? Profoundly, I think, is what you are left with. What is the connection between this violence in this story and the violence that's reflected in the stories about war?
Well, let me focus in on this story. Let me just add one more piece to the story, and then I want you to straighten me out about it. Another important part of the story is when Nick Adams, when the guys who planned to do the killing give up and leave, Nick runs to the potential victim and tries to give him the information that tries to warn him, and he is frustrated in the sense that the potential victim just kind of doesn't seem to think there's anything to be done about it. Now as I said earlier, the story just kind of falls off, and you see a life-changing message there. What happened to him?
Here you've got a young man who realizes something about the complexity. He's done a brave thing, hasn't he? Yeah. By going and risking his life. He knows those guys. Why aren't they going there? Nevertheless, he is going to risk. The advice is don't get involved. Don't get involved. And then the advice his friend gives him, don't think about it. Well, Nick's going to think about it, isn't he? And he's going to think about it. And later we realize this guy's going to be a writer. This is one of the things he's going to write about. And he's going to write about it because it tells us something really profound about the kind of species we are as human beings, the kind of world we live in, and the threats that there. Hey, we thought we were off in Europe fighting because that's where all the oppression and where the bad guys were. And here we are in Chicago and the suburbs of Chicago and what should be a nice, wholesome American town. And instead, we have killers.
Well, Joe Flora is the author of a new book called Reading Hemingway's Men Without Women, and he's shown us part of what he does in that book by describing one of Hemingway's important stories. It's a part of that short story collection called The Killers. And when we come back, maybe we can persuade Joe Flora to do the same thing with another story or two in that important short story collection of Ernest Hemingway. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, our friend and longtime Carolina English professor of literature and former chairman of the English department. Joe Flora has written another new book called Reading Hemingway's Men Without Women. And this Joe Flora's book is a work based on a collection of short stories by Ernest Hemingway. And what Joe Flora has done is give us a guide map to those of us who'd like to read in a little bit more depth these stories or have questions about it. You can go, Joe, we can go to your book if we have a question about the short story, and more than likely it's a question that's been raised before and you will have tagged it. Sort of right along with the text of the short story, you explain things that people have raised or observations that you've made or that other scholars have made, so that you got it all in one place, right where you need it.
That's what I try to do, although I am always aware and invite that there are going to be other things to be said and that someone is going to say, but did you notice this? And say, oh, thank you for pointing that out. That's, you're right. That's there. Or sometimes I might think, well, that might push it a little bit. But that's what you read Hemingway's story in the way you read a poem, in which there are hidden meanings and you worry about a line, you worry about a word. So often all of those things become important. So often reading the short story is like reading a poem.
Well, I would just like to thank you because I think, you know, Hemingway wrote a lot of short stories, and most of us right now aren't going to go back and read them all. But if you, with the guide that you've given us, the place to start reading them is in the middle of the complete short stories, is in this, the stories that form the collection that we're talking about, Men Without Women. So read one of those stories, and then if you got some questions, get Joe Flora's book and go to the chapter on that particular short story, and you'll have a guidepost. All right, now, one of my favorite stories that came out of it, and this is because I guess I'm still reliving my own adolescence, but this is a story called 10 Indians. And will you tell us about this story?
10 Indians. Oh, wonderful story, I think. It is about the experience of so many young men, Americans, really, coming to terms with independence. It takes place on the 4th of July. And at an age of questioning a parent, which is what happens to Nick at the end of the story, his father tells him something that he doesn't want to hear. I don't think the father is lying. Maybe he doesn't tell all. It has to do with that very difficult subject so often for fathers to talk about to sons, human sexuality, to love, all the kinds of things that are just occurring to this young man.
Well, what happens is that this is another Nick Adams story, I guess.
This is another Nick Adams story.
So Nick is a young teenager, has got a crush, at least, on a young woman. And it's complicated because it becomes racial, because up in this part of the world, the Indians were the lower category of people, or at least different category of people, and not one which parents would want their children, a mixed marriage between a white boy, a regular white boy, and an Indian girl, or a love affair, would be something that family would have some worries about. But Nick is beginning to develop an attraction for, is it Prudence?
Prudence.
Yeah. And so he comes home one day and his daddy says he's seen Prudence out with another boy, and he implies at least that they were in the bushes making love.
Threshing around.
And so I read the story and said, that's a smart daddy. He's just made up this story to get his. He's made up this story to get his boy away from the Indian girl, on the basis of cheating. And poor Nick, at least for a moment, goes into great despair. He wakes up the next morning, and it's not as tough on him. But your commentary and the commentary of everybody else, nobody went in the direction. Well, there was some suggestion that he might be, that the doctor might be exaggerating the story.
Yeah, threshing around. Could that be heavy petting for a doctor who is Victorian and Nick can't bear to raise the subject with his dad either. He said, were they happy? Were they happy? He can't ask the question either.
Yeah, well, those were the where I thought I got off on the wrong track was I got off on the track of whether the doctor had or the daddy had made up the story totally out of whole cloth to try to get Nick or to try to get him off it. And the real sophisticated analysis was the dialogue, was the analysis, the dialogue between the young man and his daddy as to how to ask the question and how to give the answer. And it was just trouble. So you, as you say, you get a different commentary from different people, you just have to take it and say, well, this guy's wrong. That's an interesting observation.
Yeah. And you cannot say absolutely that. I think why you could think, oh, maybe the doctor just made it up. But I don't think so, because how did the doctor not know that the Trudy and the guy were off up into town with the other Indians, and he wasn't one of those Indians they found along the road dead drunk. The father knew that he was there, and if Nick had seen them, so there is some truth here.
Well, we'll debate that another time, and I've gotten you off course only, in my view, to show how deeply involved you've gotten in these stories of Ernest Hemingway and how richly, how even richer they are when you have somebody like Joe Flora holding your hand through the vehicle of his new book, reading Hemingway's Men Without Women, to enjoy it even more. And Joe, thanks for the book and also for sharing all of this with us today.
My pleasure, DG.
Joe Flora has been our guest. Thanks to him, and thanks to all y'all for listening. I'll be back same time tomorrow.